Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. It is Thursday, the 25th, and we have a great show for you today. Two fantastic guests. First up, we have Wayne Elliott, our favorite Canadian entrepreneur and environmentalist. And then after that, Dan Hampton will be with us to talk about some summer reading. You know, not every interview needs to be about entrepreneurship. We need to take a break every once in a while and enjoy some summer books. And so I'm excited to have Dan on the show and talk about his book on the Doolittle Raid during World War II, one of my favorite history pieces. Anyway, great show today. Appreciate you being with us. And we're going to get started right now with Wayne Elliott. He is Canadian ship demo, lithium recycler, and incredible entrepreneur. Wayne, welcome back. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Jim. How are you doing?
I am well today. All right, you got some things you want to talk about. Tell us the story and get us set up.
Okay, I thought what I'd mentioned today, we've talked a lot about business, and we've certainly covered a great number of my mistakes and over the past dozen or so shows. But I wanted to raise this for folks to consider. Chances are we all know someone or more than someone who just cannot admit to making a mistake or taking ownership in, as I would call it, ownership in their mistakes. And I've just had it, it isn't the first time it's happened, but it kind of came to a head for a friend of 58 years. And it's funny that I had to think back, Jim. The first time it happened was when we were age 16 and there was some trouble and it was his fault. And he told my dad it was me. And we had a fight that day, and he moved back to his house. He'd been living with us for the summer. So I've known him all these years since. Now, I must say, he's been an employee of one government agency or another for 50 of those years, or 45 of those years, something like that anyway.
Interesting detail.
Yeah, until we hired him. Now, I haven't had a lot of experience with friends that work for the government. But, of course, my lawyer explained this to me 50 years ago. Pardon me, government people, no matter what division, what part of the government, what government level, federal, provincial, or state, municipal, they, as my lawyer would call it, they live in a box. They're in a box. Notwithstanding common sense or financial prudence or anything like that, there's rules and they cannot step outside that box. The policies, the rules are what they are. And unlike, you know, private industry and the rest of us, we're not in a box. We can, if you're in business and you have a sensible idea, you want to change something, you can do it. But the government employees, they are in this box. It's no judgment against them. It's just the way it is. Well, what I've learned through my former friend is that the way that they can handle getting what they want, doing what they want, is simply lying. Got out of the doctor. Got to go to the physiotherapist, got to go to the chiropractor, the dentist, whatever. They want time off, a week off, death in the family. Any excuse is pretty much taken, accepted. And in this fellow's case, that's what he always did, was lie. And it's so easy to tell the truth. It's just so easy to tell the truth. I've always found it easy. You don't have to remember what you said. It's just the truth. Well, I kind of sloughed it off for years when he came to work with us. Little things I would not pay attention, or I would, you know, turn a blind eye. And then, you know, things came to a head, and it went much further than I thought. he had a senior position, and with one of the business units that I was looking after, I just found this out recently as well. He's telling the salesman, don't listen to Wayne. We're not going to sell that in liquid, so don't promote it, don't offer it, which is really something when they go beyond their boss's instructions and wishes. But it's a real danger sign, Jim, for anyone in business that's going to hire somebody. Pardon me. And of course, sometimes it takes time to know a person like that, or you have to actually have something happen that you catch. My dad always told me, you can watch a thief, but you can't watch a liar. And that's true. You cannot watch a liar. And my goodness, I was just so upset by this, especially being a friend for almost 60 years. And he just cannot, no matter what it is, admit that he's made a mistake. And it's potentially a very dangerous thing in business. As far as his staff goes, those types of people will often be, you know, anything goes for the staff. Well, you want the day off? Sure, you know, go ahead. I once went into the office of, I believe there was 11 at that time in the main office, and nine were gone one day. And I guess, you know, he had given everybody the permission, whatever their reason was for not being there. But the entitlement can really be something. And private enterprise isn't like that. You know, the I've found with government people is that they don't have to be as accountable. Pretty tough to get fired from a government job. It really is. These unions, for example, in the education department here in Canada, it's the richest union in the world, the Ontario Teachers Federation. They own sports teams, meat packing plants. They're very, very wealthy and very strong union. Even when teachers get into trouble for mishandling youth, you know, right down to dating kids that they're teaching. It costs so much for the government to prosecute that most of it goes unchecked. And
right.
So it's something really to watch for. For my sake, I can't think of other people I've ever hired that spent a career with the government. And maybe that's why I just knew that there's, you know, for example, and this fellow's whole family works for the government in one place or another. And you take, I think they call it Canada Services, and that's where you would go if you need a new passport, a visa, if you're coming into Canada, you want to be a landed immigrant, any of those services. Well, we've had 2 million people in Canada, immigrants, waiting for permission to go to work. Now Canada is paying for them, putting them up in motels and so forth, paying them. But the Canada Services people are in no rush to pick up the speed at all. And we need the workers in Canada. The last few years, no matter who you talk to, no matter what business, and no matter what job description, everybody needed more people. Well, these government employees at Canada Services, they're not going to pick up the speed. I don't know whether they ever work overtime or not, but huge lineup makes a big difference to the country, and you know they're not accountable when it comes to that. You know, it's like crossing the border, really. If there can be a lineup of a mile, that's not those officers' problems. they're going to take whatever time they feel they need with each person or each vehicle crossing. So I've just found that it's less, you know, they have strong unions, the government workers, and maybe in their defense, when they do good work, I don't know, maybe there's probably no bonuses. There's probably no reward for doing a great job. I don't know that for sure, but I don't think there is. Maybe a chance of promotion. But I'll tell you, it's a very dangerous thing, and especially when there's lying involved and you're not getting the truth. It's pretty tough. It's like, I don't play poker, but I imagine it would be like playing blind poker. You don't get to see your cards, and you've got to decide on what you're going to bet. So I just wanted to bring out that point, and I think a lot of people know someone who just cannot be wrong. Cannot make a mistake. I'm not talking about a strong-willed person, or I'm talking about somebody who just cannot take ownership in something they've done that didn't work out. And
Wayne, as a boss, what do you do in that situation? Do you fire them?
Well, I certainly would have in this situation. He doesn't work for me now. He works for one of the family companies, but not for me. But I certainly would have after this last round. And some of the most outrageous things, accidents, for example. There was an accident involving this fellow, not a car accident, but an accident. And he didn't do it on purpose, but still could not admit that he did it. And outrageous, really. To me, it's like having an accident and saying, no, I didn't have the accident. And I'm not talking about in a car, but, so yes, that would be my answer. If it happens again with anybody who's under my charge, actually it has, Jim, it has in another business that I'm the chief ticket and director. And, this person is, could not be wrong, could not be mistaken, could not take direction, even though was dropping the ball on this part of their job. And so instead of accepting constructive criticism from their supervisor, they went on sick leave. And, you know, in this world, it's a pretty easy thing to do. You need a doctor's note and then off you go. And but once again, a person who just cannot be wrong must be right. So it's, I just wanted to bring that up today because it's something I don't think we often think about. And when a person's in business, you know, you're trying to hire the best person or the best people that you can. And that's really something to watch for. I took to years ago when I was involved in the interview process, asking people at your last job, what's the biggest mistake you made? And, you know, most people are honest and will tell you. If someone can't think of one, you probably have one of those characters on your hands. I mean, who among us hasn't made mistakes, Jim, really?
Well, I haven't. So.
Well, I sure have. And the more you do, the more a person does.
That it's mind-boggling. I'm just blown away by how I keep making the same mistake again and again, it seems, too, sometimes.
So. Well, I've done that, too, Jim. And I always... considered myself a very fair person, and I always want to be fair. I was an athlete. I didn't want to play in a game where a referee was biased one way or another. A baseball umpire was biased. Who wants to play in a rigged game? I don't even want to win a game like that, and then much less lose one. But you know, and the more a person does, you would expect the more mistakes they've likely made. If you do nothing, if you spent your whole life on the couch watching TV, I guess as long as you didn't end up 600 pounds, you could say, I've never made a mistake. But you haven't done anything either. You haven't done much of anything. So this fairness identity I had, it actually took some self-discovery training for me, self-awareness training, to see that everything has another side to it. Every coin has two sides. And so it comes down to, okay, what is being too fair? I'll give you some examples. I'm thinking of one fella now that worked for the company eight different times, right from a teenager, and always trouble and ended up quitting or getting fired or whatever it was, and we kept taking him back. Now, that fellow worked out in the end. It only took 30 years and six or seven or eight tries. So maybe that's too fair. We've done this a lot, taking back people. Some of our work is very hard work. You can't get just everybody to go out when it's 30 below and cut steel, or when it's 90 Fahrenheit and humid to cut steel and in the sun. But we've been too lax. You know, at some point we need to learn that, wait a minute now, the guy had five tries, it didn't work out, so this probably isn't too wise. And, you know, I've done it. Our company's certainly done it. And how often does it work out? I don't know. I don't want to exaggerate, but I'd be surprised if it were 1 out of 10. I really would. In the long run, I mean, that a person changes their ways and grows up, matures, whatever, and stops causing those troubles. But it's so important, the the hiring process, because these days with human rights and such, it's kind of akin to adopting a child. Great responsibilities here in Canada, great responsibilities come with hiring someone. So you'd like to do a good job in the selection process. Of course, then there's the cost of hiring someone, putting them through the training process, which means someone else has been involved with them for a considerable length of time, depending on the job and job title. And then to lose them or have to let them go, you start all over again, and it's just very costly. In our operations, the orientation is a two-day affair, and then there's the training. Training after that, there's the medical, the pulmonary tests, all this other stuff. So it's quite expensive to hire someone, and doing a less than good job at it, of course, is a costly thing. And sometimes we can, and I've done this, our company has done this in the past, where a person's not really working out and you let it go, and you promote a person and it's not working out. This has happened. I don't want to exaggerate, but 10 times in my career, at least, where you'll promote somebody beyond their level of competence and hope it works out. Well, it doesn't work out. It'll never work out. I think that's one time you can say the word never. It just doesn't work out. So it's just so important. I'm not involved in the most of our companies hiring or any longer. But it's very, very, very important. And the one fellow who has spent quite a lot of time in human rights told me that you're better off to make no hire than a bad or wrong hire, because of all those things you'll go through, you know, that ends up a waste of time and money and effort. So you're better off not hiring until you find the person that you really think is the right one for the job.
I think that's good advice.
One, wanted to get that off my chest, Jim.
I'm glad you did. Tell us a little bit more about your adventures with Dr. Wilson Greatbat.
Yeah, he was quite the impressive man. My goodness, that must be 30, maybe a little more than 30 years ago. I'm sure he's passed away long before now.
He has. I looked it up.
He was an elderly gentleman then. I was so impressed. His operation, his physical plant, if you will, was like a park. There were deer running around there were some acres. There was deer running around, and it was just beautiful. He invented, I think I told you, the pacemaker, the heart pacemaker.
That's right.
And then he invented the lithium ion battery to run the pacemaker. And he had the first process to not really recycle those batteries, but to deactivate them so they were no longer reactive and dangerous. And obviously a brilliant man. And I think what I was most impressed about, he wasn't in the fancy office and plant buildings. Dr. Greatbat worked in an old house. He might have lived there, Jim. I don't know. It was maybe his home, but a very old two-story house, solid brick house. And that was his laboratory, you know, and his workspace. And what a, you know, some of these geniuses are a little eccentric as well, but he, you know, what he accomplished was really something when you think about it. The pacemaker and that battery too. You'd hate to have them open up your chest twice a year to change the battery. So it was brilliant. The lithium ion coin cell, they're a little like a 10-cent piece, the lithium battery that he invented. That's about, I visited his works twice, met Dr. Greatbat the one time, and just a true scientist, Jim. True scientist he was.
And how did that lead to your work?
Well, I was in the throes of wanting to copy his very primitive lithium battery deactivating process. It was quite simple, explosion-proof room, of course, and even the hammer mill was made of steel that busted the batteries apart, because they, you know, every battery with an explosion, it's a lot cheaper to weld steel than it is a nickel alloy or any of the stainless metals. And it was a pretty cool setup. Then he had a fire. Almost everyone in the business has had a fire to do with lithium batteries. And now these MRF, these municipal garbage collection areas, transfer stations, we also call them, more and more are there fires caused by lithium batteries. And Dr. Greatbat's outfit also had a fire, and fire is usually in storage, Jim, where something will happen, water will get in, there'll be a breached battery or something like that, it's quite a fire. A lithium fire is really something. With an amount that you can put on your pinky finger, much smaller than the top of your pinky finger. I told you that we had a fire with pure lithium metal, light as styrofoam too. It's very, very light in weight, and a speck the size of a lead in a pencil. Got out of the small granulator, dropped on the floor, and one of the workers' drop of sweat is what ignited it. By the time we got it out, it had burned through a 13-inch thick cement floor right to the earth, about 6 feet in diameter. So we were discussing this on the last show, the dangers, and I for one wish they'd come up with an alternative to lithium for some of these energy sources. And I don't know how many people know that lithium is a reactive metal, and my goodness, if you think water is going to put it out, it's It's worse than gasoline on a fire.
And why did you think that you should start a lithium recycling? Obviously, you were getting a lot of it out of the ships.
No, it wasn't out of the ships. It was out of our battery company's public collections. We had 5,200 collection sites in the province of Ontario. And we received batteries from six or seven different countries, including the United States.
Go back in time. Go back in time at the very beginning. Talk about how you got into it yourself. What? Why were you thinking this was a smart idea?
Well, it was from these collections that we got primarily the alkaline batteries. That's the the process that we invented in house. That's the currently the best demonstrated technology in the world. The alkalines, the non-rechargeables. But when you do these public collections, Jim, you get all types. Lithium, nickel metal hydride, nickel cadmium, mercury, lead. You get all they have the small consumer batteries in just about all the chemistries now. So it's made it a more challenging job as we went along. There are literally thousands of batteries from the D size on down to the small coin cells, tiny coin cells even. And we have to, our plant had to sort them and then process them ourselves or ship them off to an approved processor of that chemistry. For example, we never processed nickel cadmium. We didn't have a process. We were actually in the throes of doing that, putting in a process. And what happens with the nickel cadmium is they're heated up in like an oven. The cadmium has a very low melt temperature, so it's fumed off and then recondensed into cadmium sold in sticks and balls, literally like a drumstick and a round ball the size of a pool table ball or snooker ball. And then what you're left with is the nickel scrap that has been decontaminated from that cadmium. Cadmium is the second most dangerous metal to human health. Mercury is first, lead is third. Lithium is just called a reactive metal because of it is reactive. The water moisture in the atmosphere is plenty of moisture to get a lithium fire going. So that's what makes them so reactive and dangerous. But our goal, you know, and of course we didn't have the manufacturer's support. The big companies you think of that sell batteries that you see on TV have done a big job demoting battery recycling, resisting it the world over. Europe does the most, and they've been doing it the longest. But the... if you looked at the statistics for the whole world, it's pathetic that in 2024, maybe 2 or 3% of consumer batteries actually get recycled. We had it up to 54% in Ontario until they breached our contract, and in the end, we couldn't collect any more fees from them, so we sold that company's assets, and there's another company struggling with those guys now. Our next move was the primary lithium just to deactivate. And then of course we would recover the metal jacket. That's just metal scrap and metal can be remelted an infinite number of times. It doesn't matter what metal it is, in a furnace, copper, brass, aluminum, steel, stainless steel, every single metal is infinitely recyclable in a industrial furnace like that. Zinc, all of them. So we would have recycled the jacket, the case, and we'd have made lithium hydroxide with. Actually, baking soda is the main ingredient, and water. Once the battery's deactivated, we're taking the black mass. You can make lithium hydroxide. You can make lithium carbonate, which is a little more expensive. The challenge today for these people that are trying to, they're getting the big contracts from General Motors and the like, and Tesla. Tesla just threw the towel in on their efforts to recycle lithium batteries. Recycle them to the extent, Jim, that the lithium metal can be reused again as lithium metal in batteries. Heck of a challenge. Tesla just gave up on that. There were 15,000 people laid off, including our former chief engineer was laid off because they get very, very challenging to, if you understand what I mean, to recycle lithium from scrap batteries to an extent and quality that it can be used again in new batteries. So I really don't know of a, the one company, you know, announced here in Canada, oh, it must be 5 years ago now, you know, process lithium ion batteries, vehicle batteries, EV electric vehicle, they call it batteries, which are just small cells hooked together in series. And they went to the stock market to raise $600 million. They raised $1 billion and they're in trouble right now without a final process. It's a very complex process to build. When we went through the science ourselves, and we had just an incredible PhD engineer that was on our staff, an older gentleman, he's passed away now. It was going to cost over $160 million just to build the recycling part of it, not to have quality of lithium that could be used in new batteries again, but just to recycle it, recover it, and deactivate the batteries and recover the lithium, but not in a form that they could use again for batteries. So it's quite an undertaking. I don't know. I'm no scientist, Jim, and I keep thinking that at some point, you know, we're going to think that this was maybe a wrong turn. They're making and starting to make green hydrogen. Of course, wind power, solar power. They're doing more offshore now with the wind power. These giant wind turbines. The trouble is, it takes one heck of a lot of them to replace the fossil fuels that we've been burning in our cars and trains and planes and ships and heating our homes and so forth. It's a heck of a thing to replace that quantity. And of course, the costs, as we all are beginning to experience, but the costs are going to be way up. I think that the regardless, with all these various alternative energy sources, I think the cost of electricity in our homes or at somebody's workplace or a steel mill, electric furnace steel mill, it's a serious issue for them, that's for sure. I think at the end of the day, the cost of electricity in the next 6-7 years will be triple. So, you know, if your bill at home was $100, you might expect $300. So it's quite a change that we're going through here. And of course, we have good incentive to do it, but I think we started a little bit late, Jim, and it's not going to be cheap, of course.
Wayne, we are about out of time. Very interesting. And I'm glad you got that off your chest. And I got a couple more details about the lithium and excited to continue to learn more next time. Thanks for being with us.
All right, Jim. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. And we will be right back. We are back, and again, thank you so much for being with us today. Very excited to introduce my next guest. Please welcome Lieutenant Colonel Dan Hampton, retired. Thank you for your service, sir. He was a much decorated fighter pilot, 150 combat missions in 3 different wars, wounded twice, and flew air patrols during the terrorist attacks at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, studied at Oxford, that's very impressive, and got a master's from a place called Dirtmouth, which is not impressive. Very sorry about that. I went to school on the other side of the mountain, so I have to tease Dartmouth whenever I can. He is a best-selling author, and his new book that we're excited to talk about today has nothing to do with entrepreneurship, but it's one of my favorite stories, and it's the summertime. And so we're going to give you some beach reading for the end of the summer here. He has just released Vanishing Act, the enduring mystery behind the legendary Doolittle raid over Tokyo. Lieutenant Colonel Hampton, welcome. How you doing?
It's my pleasure, Jim. Thanks very much.
So there's a little bit more to the Doolittle raid, but let's let everyone understand what the Doolittle raid is who don't know the story. Set the picture. We get our asses kicked in Pearl Harbor, so...
Well, yeah. So, you know, this is the first 4 months of our involvement in World War II, and neither President Roosevelt nor any of the top military folks liked being on the defensive, which we were, because Congress being Congress had let the military lapse for the time in between the First World War and this one. So we really kind of had our backs against the wall, and they were looking for some way to send a message not only to our allies that we are definitely in the fight, but also to the Japanese that, you know, you've bitten off more than you can chew and we're coming after you. And so they dreamed up the Doolittle raid. It actually came from a submariner. He was the one who thought it up. And then it got handed over to the aviators, and they're the ones who decided that, hey, listen, you know, the Navy doesn't have planes with long enough range to reach Japan, and the Army Air Corps doesn't have any place to launch their long-range planes from, so why don't we put Army bombers on a Navy aircraft carrier? And that was sort of the genesis of the original Doolittle mission. But as part of that, and that's what this book is about, one of those planes did not go to China. In fact, it didn't even go to Tokyo.
Why were we doing the... give us one or two more sentences. The Doolittle raid, the whole point was to do something to return, to get some morale back, right? It was a crazy, stupid idea that had a very little chance of success and did very little damage, even by design. Is that all true?
Well, I wouldn't have called it necessarily a stupid idea. These guys were all volunteers. They all,
you know, this is crazy stuff.
You know, it was a long shot, and they knew they weren't going to do much material damage, but they wanted to strike a psychological blow against the Japanese and give the Americans and all of our allies a morale boost.
And how did they do? What was the success of the, you know, the major part of the raid? Not your part yet. Let's not talk about Russia yet.
Well, I had the assistance of a Japanese researcher who's made it his life's work to find out where those bombs really went. And with the exception of the ones, you know, that were outside of Tokyo that were dropped on other cities, none of them really went to where they should have. In fact, you remember that great movie, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, about Ted Lawson. He never even got to Tokyo. He actually dropped his bombs on Yokohama. Not that it matters, okay? The whole point, like I said, was to strike a blow against the Japanese, and these guys did that. Was it a success or not? Yeah, I would say it was, because the Japanese got really, really, you know, pissed off about it, and it goaded them into a naval action, which led to the Battle of Midway, which led to their defeat, which they might not have done if they hadn't, you know, been stuck in the face over this raid. So it really had some long-term effects, not really tactical, but some long-term strategic effects.
As I was telling you before we came on air, Midway is one of my favorite battles to study, and I love both of the movies, the original Charlton Heston version in the 70s, and then they did a more recent version, which I think is an interesting political statement too. The more the recent one was entirely financed by Chinese money, from what I understand. And if you look at the credits, there's a lot of Chinese names in there, and I think there's a lot politically behind that. But that's another conversation. How many planes went over Japan? How many actually dropped bombs? How many successfully made it to China where they were supposed to land to get recovery?
There were 16 total that were launched. Originally it was 15, but because of what this book is about, you know, one was added. 15 bombers dropped on the Tokyo area and cities to the south. the eighth plane, which the story is about, did not. None of them made it to China, at least not to land. They either bailed out over China or they ditched off the coast. The only plane that landed was the one that went to Russia.
All right. And of the people who, of the airmen, how many survived and were able to make it home even after a year or so?
The five guys that that landed in Russia, they all eventually made it back. They were interned, and then they were released. The other guys, several of them were captured by the Japanese and put into POW camps, and a couple of them died while they were in captivity. Four of them ended up surviving the war from the POW camps and made it back. And then of the others, they all, you know, this is a world war. They all, after the raid, they were all dispersed and put into different flying units. And I think 13 of them ended up getting killed in other theaters of operation. So, you know, it was a world war they had to fight. So there was taken as a whole, there was a fairly high casualty rate.
And their reunion every year was famous.
That's true. In fact, Doolittle delayed the initial reunion until everybody was accounted for or had made it back, which were those last four guys, you know, that were rescued out of. Actually, they were in China, and they were rescued right at the end of the war before they were executed.
All right, so that's the original plan, and that was what the movies were made about, and that sort of is the legend. But underneath all of that, there was another super secret mission going on, right, Dan?
Yeah,
there was a mission within the mission.
That's right. They figured, hey, as long as these guys are all over there, what better way to get what we need than to have one of these planes go do something else? And that's what Vanishing Act is about. It's about that plane that ended up going to Russia. It was not an accident. It was not a mistake in navigation. They did have a lower amount of fuel than the other airplanes, but that was intentional to give them an excuse to go to Russia. And then that's what the book is about, is why they went.
Why did they go? What was their mission?
Well, you don't want me to ruin the story, do you? All I'll tell you is that it was intentional, you know, and they had a cover story, which was, hey, we're short of fuel. We didn't have a choice. We'd never make it to China, which was true. But most of the other ones weren't going to make it all the way anyway, because they had to launch from the USS Hornet hundreds of miles earlier than they had planned. So they were all short of fuel. But these guys did, in fact, make it all the way over to the eastern part of what was then the Soviet Union. And like I said, they were the only plane that landed.
All right. You're right. We don't want to give away the much more. I guess you're right. We want to maintain some mystery as to why they went to Russia. Let's do talk, though, about all of the subterfuge that they did beforehand. Doolittle didn't even know about the true mission. Is that correct? And also, they altered the engine for particular purposes. Talk about those things. The subterfuge behind.
Doolittle knew about it. He would have had to have known about it. But unlike today, and this is what's really hard for, you know, modern folks to understand, this was all done verbally. Okay, there were no written orders, not even for the Doolittle raid. Okay, first of all, they didn't have time, and these weren't the kind of guys that dealt with paperwork, especially Hap Arnold. You know, his grandson helped me quite a bit with the book, and whenever they could avoid paperwork, they did it. So there's no paper trail for any of this. It was all, you know, like I said, verbal. Doolittle knew about it. In fact, he and the pilot of the eighth plane, the one that went to Russia, they roomed together while the guys were in Florida, you know, training for the mission. And they would have worked out all the details between them during that time. And one of the details was, all right, we have to have a plausible excuse for this so that when we land in Russia and they inspect the plane, they see that, yes, in fact, we are out of fuel. So they modified the carburetors out of all those airplanes. And remember, there were spare aircraft, too. There were eight spare crews that were part of this mission. And that's one of those subterfuges you mentioned, because if they needed an extra plane, and they needed two of them, actually, because two of them had been taken out due to accidents, why didn't they use the spare crews and planes that had already been modified and were trained for the mission? Why did they bring in Ed York and four other guys that he'd never flown with, you know, to be part of this? So there were some things that just didn't add up, starting with that, which led me to believe it was intentional. And then when you look a little bit deeper into, you know, other things that happened, like the carburetors, the only carburetors on any of those planes that were switched back to the original factory settings were the ones on plane 8, which means it used more fuel, which means they'd be short of fuel, which means they had an excuse to go to Russia. So there's a lot of little things like that that pointed to a deliberate plan.
How do you research this when nothing is written, when there's not documents for you to find and have that smoking gun moment in someone's attic?
Well, there were after-action reports that were done by Ed York and the crew. Jimmy Doolittle, wrote a book, and there were a couple of very small clues in there. But the after-action reports, one of them was for public consumption, but I got a hold of one that Ed York did specifically for military intelligence. And he would have been, you know, very straightforward and truthful and accurate with military intelligence reports, because that's how, you know, future decisions were made. And there were some clues in there that led me to believe, that convinced me and Hap Arnold's grandson and the son of the co-pilot of that bomber that, yes, in fact, all of this, you know, had been planned. These guys never talked about it. Okay. And the co-pilot wrote a book later in life, and he stuck to the cover story. All right, but there were still some, you know, if you're a pilot, if you're a combat pilot yourself, you're going to see some details that didn't add up. They, you know, nobody else would really get it, but to someone else, you know, who's been in similar situations, there were a couple of small red flags, and that's what I used as a basis for the research.
How long did it take you?
It usually takes me about a year to write a book. This took a little bit over a year, because I had to get the information from Japan and, you know, the National Archives, and they're still using COVID as an excuse not to open up. So, you know, it took a little bit longer for this one.
This is the 9th book?
I think it's the 8th book. Maybe it's 9. I don't know. I didn't know, right? But I think this was the 8th book, yeah.
Interestingly, you wrote one on Charles Lindbergh, totally tangentially. What are your thoughts on the kidnapping of his baby?
What do you mean exactly?
I don't know. There's a lot of different theories out there. Certainly, the man who was executed, I think there's overwhelming evidence that he's innocent. There's all sorts of other evidence or suggestions about who else was involved. Have you got any thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on Charles Lindbergh?
Well, he's an enigma now, isn't he? I mean, he was unquestionably a very brave guy. He was also later in life fairly controversial. And I focused that book, the focus of that book was, as the title implies,
the actual flight.
Yeah, because Scott Berg wrote the definitive work, you know, on Lindbergh. It's like a 600-page tome on every detail of his life, but I think he devoted, you know, just a handful, like less than 20 pages on the actual flight that made him famous. So my book was just the opposite. It was all on the details of the flight. You know, he got a bad reputation in the 30s because he was an America firster. There's evidence that he actually was working for the U.S. government when he went to Germany, and he did in fact make a report to them on what he saw regarding German aircraft manufacturing. So I think he was misunderstood in a lot of ways. He didn't help himself out because he wasn't very articulate. I mean, he could write extremely well, but he didn't speak very well, and people would misunderstand him quite a bit. I And the interesting thing I put in that book is he wanted to keep America out of the war until we were attacked. And then he was one of the first people to jump up and say, hey, it's my country. We've been attacked. We need to fight. And he tried to get back into the Army Air Corps, but Roosevelt didn't like him and wouldn't let him. That didn't stop him from going out to the Pacific as a civilian, though, and flying 50 combat missions. A lot of people don't know that, but he did. So he was an interesting guy, no doubt about it.
Call signs are given by the community, right? Other pilots sort of develop a call sign. Is that true for a pilot?
Yes, you do not name yourself, and you're not given it by somebody who's not a fighter pilot.
And how did you become Two Dogs?
Obviously, my mother might listen to your show, so I'm not going to give that one away.
Okay.
They're usually, nobody's named Maverick or Iceman. That's just Hollywood. That's kind of funny. They're usually given because you did something stupid, which Two Dogs is not, or they're given because of some physical thing or, something you did that was funny or noteworthy, along those lines.
What's your favorite example of a crazy call sign that someone had to live with?
I knew a guy who was called Toto, T-O-T-O, because when he was rejoining, when we take off and then we join up to fly in formation, the F-16 in particular, it's really hard to shut the engine off. You have to rotate the throttle about 90 degrees to the left and then pull it back all the way to the stop. And somehow when he was pulling the power back to go to, minimum power, idle, he rotated the throttle, or maybe there was one of the mechanics in the throttle was broken, and he ended up shutting the engine off, which is not good when you only have one engine. So Toto means throttle on, throttle off. So that's a good example of somebody getting named for something that probably wasn't the best thing.
Something that they wish they could live down, for sure.
Yeah, well, he got the engine restarted and it ended well, but you're not ever going to live that one down, so you're stuck with it.
So F-16s have made their way to Ukraine. Let's talk politics a little bit, or military strategy. Will that make a difference in the war with Ukraine and Russia? It's been going on so long now, it's hard for us over here in America, so far away from it, to even relate or understand. And we don't get daily casualty reports or anything like that. No, you hardly ever see any stories about battles or anything. What do you think is going on? Is this going to make a difference, the F-16s?
Well, we better relate to it, because if he's not stopped in Ukraine, who knows what he's going to do next. And, anybody that's been in combat is probably the last person that advocates combat. And I'm certainly in that category. There's, there's almost always another way to solve a problem rather than fighting. But in this case, as we were talking about the Second World War earlier, there is no other option because of who you're dealing with. And Putin's a megalomaniac. He's got to be stopped. The F-16 should have been delivered a year and a half ago. Better late than never, I guess. They will make a difference if they are delivered in enough numbers, if they are delivered with the people that can keep them flying. All right, so all the maintenance folks that have to go with this. And not more, but at least as important to all of that is you have to have the right people flying them. Okay, the Ukrainians have been training their own Ukrainian pilots in a couple of different countries, including this one, for the last, 6-8 months. But they're going to have to get more pilots, and they're going to have to, we hope, hire, previously experienced F-16 pilots from Europe and the United States to make the difference until they get their Air Force back up and running.
And do you think that Ukraine has a chance? Seems to me that this is going to just be a stalemate forever. I don't know. Seems to be a stalemate.
Putin definitely has more manpower, but I think at the rate he's losing people, and this isn't, it's not the Soviet Union. You can't keep that quiet like they did back when it was communist Russia. Too many people know about it, and I think that's going to cause him a real problem. I mean, come on, they're taking tanks out of museums from World War II and renovating them and sending them to the front. So Putin definitely bit off more than he can chew. The Ukrainians will prevail as long as they are continued to be, you know, resupplied with what they need. They're perfectly willing to fight and die for their country, which is what they are going to have to do. We would do it too if we were invaded. But they've got to have help, and it looks like finally the European Union and the United States, because it's an election year, you know, are finally giving them what they really need. But it's been costly. You know, the last 8 month delay in getting all of this over to them has really cost them the momentum and a lot of folks, you know, that died that probably shouldn't have died. So I think they'll win in the end as long as we keep supporting them.
It seems to me that if all of NATO were fighting Russia, it would be a resounding NATO victory pretty quickly because of what you just said, taking tanks out of museums. It doesn't seem like Russia, I don't know if Paper Tiger is right, but it seems like that they have played their game and have a pretty weak hand at this point. And if NATO were to really throw all of NATO's resources behind it, it would be over very fast. Is that how am I doing there for a non-military guy?
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, you're being diplomatic about it. I would just go farther and say the Russian military sucks. And it always has. I mean, even when it was the USSR, you remember what caused the USSR to fall, you know, their economy collapsed. You're talking about people that, you know, can't manage to get crops in out of the field before they spoil. And yet they're going to try to go to war not with NATO, because they would, even Putin's not that stupid, or the United States. I mean, they're having to get ammunition from North Korea, for crying out loud. How bad is that? All right, when you can't make enough ammunition to support a war, because they only planned for a 10-day war. Okay, and of course that was never just going to be it. And so now he's having to get ammunition from North Korea and Iran. How bad off do you have to be to take stuff from those clowns, right? And it's not working for them. So the only thing he's got to throw at Ukraine are bodies. And there are plenty of bodies to do that. But like I said earlier, I think that's gonna end up costing him in the end, because the Russian people eventually aren't going to put up with it, I hope.
Yes. Have you heard anything about the rumors about him being sick?
You mean besides mentally? No, I haven't.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway. All right. What about the Trump assassination attempt? Any thoughts there you want to share?
Well, you know, I was heartened to see people beginning to finally say, hey, you know, this uncivil, violent rhetoric that I had never seen in my lifetime in this country that's been prevalent over the last couple of years, it's got to stop, because you're going to trigger, you know, idiots like that punk kid that took a shot at him. It's not supposed to happen in America. I've been in lots of third world countries and lots of banana republics, and it's expected there. And it happens here. I mean, you know about Ford, you know about Reagan, and others before him, but it's just not the way that it should be. Politics should be conducted here. So maybe some good will come out of it, and everybody will tone it down a little bit, and we'll try to conduct this election with a little decorum and restraint, which would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yes, that would be. I don't think it'll last for 3 days.
Well, maybe not, but hope springs eternal.
Yes.
I think the Secret Service has a few things to answer for. I don't know how, with two counter-sniper teams, you fail to see some punk kid climbing on the roof of a building. I don't know how you missed that, but, you know, obviously they did. So I think there's going to be a little bit of a shakeup there, so we'll see.
What about Malaysia? What flight was that? 3-something, the Malaysia flight that disappeared into nowhere. What's your guess on that?
I'm kind of flattered to say that my guess turned out to be what really happened, because again, as a pilot, I put myself in that guy's shoes, because it had to be the pilot, one of the pilots. And I got all the maps and all the data, and I said, all right, if I wanted to make this plane disappear, what would I do? And I would give everybody a very clear, you know, last fix on my position, and then I would vanish. And that's exactly what that guy did. He flew over a radar station heading one way, and then he descended down below the radar coverage and turned and headed out into the Indian Ocean. And that's exactly where you would go to make a plane disappear, because that's a big, empty piece of space. In fact, there's a lot of gaps in satellite coverage out there. In parts of it, you know, it's 20, 25,000 feet deep, so that's going to crush the black boxes and kill the signals. It's relatively easy to you know, incapacitate everybody on board. And what that guy did is he waited until the other pilot got up to go to the bathroom, and he locked the cockpit door and he depressurized the back of the airplane. The cockpit has its own oxygen source. And so when you depressurize the back of the plane, nobody has oxygen, everybody goes to sleep, and eventually they die, and you've got the plane to yourself. And that's, I'm sure, what he did. And I think they found some pieces of the wreckage off the coast of Australia, Western Australia, which is where you'd find something that went into the Indian Ocean out there. So that's where I think it is.
What's your next book on, Dan?
Spies. World War II spies.
Ah, excellent.
Just signed a contract with another publisher, and so look for that thing in 18 months or so.
And we'd love to have you back. How do we find out more, follow you online, get a copy of the book?
Well, you can get the book at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, you know, airport bookstores. I don't do a web page anymore. I've got a Facebook page that the publisher maintains, and I answer everybody. It may take me a while, but I will eventually answer, and I'm happy to hear from folks.
Fantastic. Dan, thank you so very much for being with us. Congratulations. Great beach reading for all of us interested in history, and I hope you have a great summer.
Well, my pleasure, Jim. You too. Thanks.
We're out of time for today, but you know what we do. That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone. Take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now. We'll